And I know you're going to love what you have to share tonight. Blind Day.
Norma's very nice. Actually, she's meant just as much to me in my recovery. We've had a wonderful journey together. So, I've met a lot of you people at Primary Purpose, have I not?
Yes.
Right. How many people are here tonight from Primary Purpose Group? Say aye. Oh, wow. Golly, that's really cool. For those of you who have not come to visit us on Tuesday night, 7:30 in South Austin there, we're right across the street from Kirby Lane Restaurant there on South Lamar. We meet on Tuesday night at 7:30 at the Big Methodist Church. And we're opening the Big Book, and we're really trying to bring recovery back to focused on the Big Book. What does it say? It says to show alcoholics precisely. So we want to get right down to that. And so anyway, it says to show you exactly how to find that power. So, you know, we can be precise and we can be exact in our recovery. And the Big Book will show you just exactly to have the experience that I'm going to be talking about tonight. So I think I did. It was on? What, you see a light or something? Cool. Okay, well, I'm Blind Dave. Yeah. I'm Blind Dave, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And my sobriety date is July 9th of 98. So just back the road a little ways, I got 10 years here in my life. I was born in 1948, so this year I'm also turning 60. And but I was born with very little eyesight. I was legally blind. I managed to go to public school the first and second grade. I could see the book if I put my face right down there to it. But by the end of the second grade, I couldn't see the book anymore. You know, one thing I remember particularly when I was going to public school, you know, they have the parents' night, you know, in the open house, I guess you call it, Norma. And the parents come to school, you know, and I remember going to school with my mom and dad and visiting my teachers. And they said, "So, how is he doing?" And I remember the teacher saying, "Well, you know, he really has leadership qualities." My dad was so proud of that, you know. And I can remember on the playground getting into trouble with a couple of boys. And I was a little kid. I had a growth spurt when I was in about the 6th or 7th grade. I used to be little bitty. And I remember getting in some trouble with a couple of boys out on the playground in the 2nd grade. And we're being sent to the principal, you know. And they're way taller than me. And on the way to the principal, I said, "Y'all keep your mouth shut. I do the talking." And that's the way I've always been, and still somewhat am, I guess. I'm not going to put my life in someone else's hand very easy, I can tell you. So, you know, but by the end of the second grade, I couldn't see the books anymore. So in the third grade, they got me a large print book. By the end of the third grade, I couldn't see it. So I was born in Houston, by the way. So my folks sent me up here to Austin to the blind school in 58. And I started going to the blind school there. Now, the blind school was, it's where you live on campus, a dormitory and all that. And so they had very rigid rules. And I didn't do very well in that kind of a setting. I'm glad I never had to go to the military. I know what would have happened. And I didn't do good there, particularly when I hit puberty. It got really rough. And I found out what the teacher meant by that I was a good leader. What she meant was I was a bad follower. And I made it to the 9th grade, and they finally threw me out, and then my folks talked them into letting me come back, and I went back, and then I made it about 2 more months, and they threw me out and said, "Don't send him back." So I went back to Houston and started high school. Now, my mother always raised me to go to church, made me go to church. I hated it. So when I got sent back home and was starting to go to high school, this was in 66, I figured I'm old enough now, Mom can't make me go to church. You know, she come in that Sunday morning and said, "Well, I got your clothes all pressed and laid out here ready for school." And I said, "I'm not ready for church." I said, "I'm not going." She said, "What?" I said, "I'm not going. I'm old enough to decide for myself, and I'm not going." And she started to cry, you know, and then Daddy come busting in the room and said, "What is this?" And I said, "I'm not going to church. I'm old enough to make my own decisions. And I guess he decided I meant it because he backed out of the room. And so I started high school in 66, proclaimed myself an atheist, and became very defiant against that authority as well. And was very outspoken about how I felt about all that. And there were many scenes in the bathroom at high school, you know, how the guys sneak in to go smoke a cigarette, and we'd be standing around in there. And I was going to a school that had a pretty good little Baptist part of town, a strong Christian presence there. And then Baptist boys would corner me in the bathroom all the time and try to get me talking about God, and I'd make them wish they'd never brought it up. And they would usually start backing away from me, you know, saying, "You're going to go to hell, you're going to hell." And I remember saying, you know, "To hell with you and your God." So I did not like any of that. In high school, I met a girl and started dating her, and her whole family was drunks. And so they didn't mind us drinking with them. So I usually, on the weekends, I'd just go over to their house and stay. Drank every weekend, drank all weekend. And so I was, you know, I was getting a late start because I'd been going to that boarding school where we were all, you know, walled in. And in high school it was before I really had a chance to start drinking when I went back to Houston. But it was every weekend then. And I graduated in 68. Y'all know back in the 60s we were starting to experiment a little bit with drugs. And by the way, I hear Cheech and Chong's coming to town in November. I think I'm going to go check it out. Have a few old laughs, you know. But yeah, so we were starting to experiment with drugs a little bit. And, you know, I graduated in 68. And right after that, about early 69, someone turned me on to methamphetamine. And it was really on then. It was a memorable year. You know, they said speed kills. They warned us, speed kills. But when I felt my first rush, I thought, who cares? This is the way to die. Another thing I remember about 1969, I went to a rock concert there in Houston on Halloween night, 1969. Grand Funk Railroad, any of y'all remember Grand Funk? Yes, sir, it was a big night. And there was a little local group going to open up and make their debut that night. We was all waiting to see what this band was going to sound like. It was their first, you know, first real big concert there in Houston. And it was, they had a weird name. It was like ZZ Top. And man, ZZ Top, they actually didn't sound that good that night. I saw them a few months later, they opened for Steppenwolf, and they had really gelled. They blew Steppenwolf off the stage, and had been blowing everybody off the stage ever since. So anyway, I remember that concert that night, because as I was standing out in front of the concert hall waiting to get in, a bunch of these little Jesus freaks passing out tracts started trying to talk to me about the Lord, you know. And I went into them so hard, because see, I had armed myself well with my arguments and read the books about it and all this. And the big book says we do that. We read wordy books and arm ourselves with windy arguments, and I was one of them. And you try to talk to me about God, and it was on. And I attacked them so bad, I drew a crowd that night out on the sidewalk in front of that concert hall who were cheering for me. So I remember that about 1969. But it was methamphetamine then, 69, 70, 71, 72. In 73, it was really getting bad. And I had pulled myself together the best I could and made several attempts to quit. And I remember the day when I stepped down and had a little talk with myself and accepted the fact that I guess I'm going to die a speed freak. Because it was looking bleak. And then this guy moved in next door to me, who was a Christian fella. And he came over one day, I was out in the yard, and I was probably pretty wasted, but he came over and tried to talk to me about God. And I lit into him like I did everybody else. But he was different, because I bounced off of him too. This man had something. He had the presence of God about him. He didn't flinch. He didn't get hostile. He didn't get nothing. He didn't react. He just countered all my arguments. It took him a couple of months living next door to me, but he was able to help me come to believe. He knew his book. And he shared it with me and shared his faith with me. And over a couple of months, I came to believe in his God. And he told me that he thought God could help me. And I remember the day that I kneeled down and gave my life to God. I'll never forget that day. I got up from that prayer a different person. I threw away all my drugs and all my paraphernalia. I felt free from my addiction. I really felt free from my addiction. I knew I was. But what does the big book say about that third step? See, I had a very powerful third step experience. But the big book says that what does it say immediately following the third step? That we must do a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That third step decision would have little permanent effect unless it once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Well, I didn't do all that inventory stuff. See, what I did though, because see, them church people don't know how to teach you how to do that. What I did do, this is what they taught me how to do. I went off to church with this dude and shouted hallelujah louder than anybody. They put me in charge of the music in that church. I led worship service on Sunday morning and it was hallelujah and the time was on. I want you to know it was going good for a while. And, you know, after a while I became a deacon in that church. And after a few more years, you know, I started doing a little preaching on the side, and then I got my license. I went off to East Texas and started a little church, tried my hand at being a pastor, and I learned how to do church well, I want you to know. But the big book says that if we don't do that inventory work and admit to God and ourselves and another human being and make an honest effort to make some amends, that if I don't do that work, I do not learn enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary. Talking about we alcoholics and addicts. And I hadn't done that work. All I had learned how to do was play, you know, do church. And so sure enough, the day came when I had this thought that said, you know, I had a problem with drugs. I don't. Yes, sir. Drink would hurt anything. So beginning with the idea of just having a drink or two, I started developing a real problem with alcohol. And again, the big book says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. So I started finding myself behind a pulpit preaching with a hangover. And for 20 or 25 years, teaching and preaching the Bible with a hangover became a recurring theme in my life. Each time I hit a new bottom, I'd change churches, change brands of religion, change something. We don't have our theology quite right here. You know, I don't quite have all the corners nailed down. I couldn't figure it out. And I would, you know, I would change to another church, get all excited about that. And for a while, I'd say, this new religion, it's going to fix me. And for a while, I think I was fixed. I seemed to be fixed. During one of those periods when I thought I was fixed, I moved to Austin. Because, see, I always had to move to another location and start over. You know how it is. And so I moved to Austin during one of those times when I was trying to get fixed. And I had a friend up here. We started a little music ministry. We were doing gospel music in blues form, and it really did sound good. We were playing on the streets and in little coffee houses. And one night we was in this little coffee house off 6th Street down there doing our gospel blues. And this girl heard us singing about God. She came up and introduced herself to us, and we got off the stage. And she had a little thing going with God. So I was teaching a home Bible study. I had started a little home church here in Austin. I was new in town, so I was getting that started. I invited her to come to that. So she showed up one Sunday. I found out she was in AA. Now, I was surprised when I learned that AA was a spiritual program. And I was real intrigued with its simplicity. Because I've been going in circles in confusion, trying to figure out why I can't nail all the corners down. You know, and it was the simplicity intrigued me. And so me and her became friends. I started going to AA meetings with her on Saturday. On Sunday, she came to my little home church Bible study thing, and we began a relationship for a couple of years, and then we got married. Still married. And I got to know a lot of her AA friends, and some of them would from time to time come to my little Bible study, and for a while all went well, until that recurring day that I thought it would be okay to have a drink again, and started that little snowball rolling down the mountain again. Before long, I'm living a double life again. I was trying hard to keep it hid from her and all her alcoholic friends. And you know, I was doing a good job of keeping the worst of it secret. And to me, that meant I was controlling it. one day I'm sitting in a, you know, but it's very frustrating to do that, y'all know, and it was frustrating the heck out of me. And one Saturday I was sitting at a noon meeting with my wife, like I would typically do on Saturday, but I was frustrated to the max. I was wishing she'd go off on one of her AA retreats for the weekend. I just couldn't sneak enough to satisfy me. And I'm mad at everybody. I'm just really sitting there about to explode. And this guy who happens to be my sponsor today quoted from the Big Book. He said, you know, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. He said, you know, here's the earmark of an alcoholic. He said, if you are controlling your drinking, you're not happy about it. And he nailed me to the wall that day. I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I was controlling it, I thought. But I sure was mad at everybody that day. And he said, if you are controlling your drinking, you're not happy about it. Man, I felt like this dude just shot an arrow across the room and got me right in the chest. Man, it was like he was talking at me. And he nailed me to the wall that day. And I knew I was going to have to join this fellowship and work these steps if I was ever going to stay sober and be happy about it. But that posed a little problem. See, I've been around AA enough to hear y'all talking about this rigorous honesty and this fearless humility. And that's scary when you've been kind of a little preacher living a double life. I talked to an old man around her AA group, and he was able to help me find the courage to walk into that meeting and announce to all my wife's friends who had known me all these years, my name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. It hurt me to have to do that. The religious pride, it hurt bad. You know, I like it. One time when I was a kid, I had a boil. And the little red streak was going up my arm. You know, it was getting serious. And so one day the doctor decided he better lance that. He didn't tell me that's what he was going to do. He was just holding my arm. And I'm sitting there, la, 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 you know, and he sprays it with some kind of cold something. I guess it's supposed to numb it, but it didn't do much. And he took that scalpel and went, whop, whop, cut that edge, and I like it went through the ceiling. But I want you to know that thing had been throbbing for days. And that night, it wasn't throbbing. It was draining. And the healing had started, I could tell. And that's the way I felt that day when I went in and said, oh, man, it's David, I'm an alcoholic. It was like, whop, whop. God, that hurt. But I felt the healing start right then. And I'm sure some of y'all know what I'm talking about. That was step one for me. You know, and I came to step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I had a problem with step two. What do you mean, came to believe? I came to believe 25 years ago. And has not been able to stay sober. Why should I expect it to be any different in AA? I'm not going to change my God. I'm not going to change my faith. I still got my same Lord and Savior, you know, and all that stuff. I wasn't going to change any of that. How could I expect AA to make anything different? And what about this word sanity? Are they saying I'm insane? But as I read through the Big Book, see, I found out they were talking about the insanity that precedes the first drink. I'm related to that. You know, I never heard before until I came to AA, somebody say, you know, the first drink gets you drunk. I never heard that. You know, I used to leave, and the Bible says, be not drunk with wine, but be ye filled with the Holy Ghost. And I used to preach that, you know, you can tell I can still do it. And then I'd close up church and say, well, I'm not going to get drunk, I'm just going to have a drink. Y'all were the ones that told me it was the first drink that got me drunk. I related to that. And as I read through the Big Book, I learned a whole lot more about alcoholism and about me, the alcoholic. And when I hear you people talk about it in meetings and put that book all in perspective for me, thank God for Big Book thumpers. Come join us. Tuesday night, 7:30. You know, y'all put that Big Book in perspective for me, and it started coming clear. You know what I came? This was step two for me. I came to believe that the same God that I'd had for 25 years, who had not been able to keep me sober over there in that other fellowship, that somehow in AA, using this new medium, that my same old God was going to now talk to me in the language of the big book, and he was going to use the voice of other alcoholics. And I was going to hear my same old God in a brand new way, like I've never heard him before. And I came to believe that he might could restore me to sanity here. And that was step two for me. And I made the decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God and put myself in his hands in AA. And so as I'm reading through that step three, it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Ah, there's a price tag, isn't there? Yeah, let me tell you where I was the day I read that. Because you see, I'd gone to school, I got my license to be a massage therapist, and I hadn't been in business very long when I started developing tendonitis that was hurting me so bad it was threatening to put me out of business. And, I was getting real scared behind all this, and I was praying about it, you know. One day someone showed up at my house and started telling me about this little home business you could do that looked like something I could do. Because, you know, blind people have to kind of go get special training and everything. And to start a new career when you're already up in your 40s is kind of scary. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And then they showed me this little home business. I thought I could do that. So I invested a few bucks and I went off to their meetings and listened to their speakers. And I'm bringing home tapes and books and learning about the company and their products. And after a while, I think, I'm ready to do this. And I took off to go with my new business. But I didn't get very far before someone showed me a better one. So I put that one aside, spend a little more money to join this other one. I'm reading their books, going to their meetings, and learning about their products and their company. And about the time I get all fired up and ready to go, I took off down the road and didn't get very far until I ran into somebody that showed me a better one. Cost a little more money to join it, but it looked like it was going to make a lot. So I joined that one. And do the same thing, study and learn and prepare and da-da-da, reading the books or listening to the tapes, and I go off to do this business. Someone showed me a better one. But I mean, it cost a lot of money to join this one, and I hadn't made back any of my money on any of them yet, but this one looked so good. I was going to make it all back on this one. I drug out the credit cards to get involved with this. And I want you to know that over a period of about 5 years, I just jumped from one to another and took my wife and me to the point of bankruptcy, trying to save myself from financial disaster. Well, the big book says that the more we fought, the worse it got. And sinking in all this fear I started drinking again, and my drinking is escalating behind all this fear. And I wind up having to come into AA. And then I read in step three that when I sincerely would take this position, I would have a new employer who was all-powerful and would provide what I needed if I would keep close to him and perform his work well. I thought, this is just what I've been looking for. What is the job? Well, I wanted to know what's the job description. Yeah, so it's right down there in the third step prayer. It says that I was to pray, God, take away my difficulties, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. His power, his love, his way of life. I said, so my job then is to give God my life, let him begin to snap all these pieces back in place, do remarkable things, it says, and my job is to share my experience, strength, and hope. I said, sign me up. And I meant it. I meant it. You know, it says on page 28 of the big book that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms, as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. So it makes it very clear that to form a relationship with our Creator, it will be upon terms. There are terms and conditions. That's why it says, if we. And the terms are right there in page 63, the third step. He would be our employer and provide what we need remarkably well. Says he will bring all his power to bear. He's all powerful and will bring all that power to bear upon my life to provide what I need, to take away all my difficulties, if And those are the terms and conditions, if I would keep close to him and perform his work well. It's kind of like a contract with God. You hear about these rock stars, y'all have heard all the stories, you know, Robert Johnson and all these cats that are supposed to have made a contract with the devil that they could be famous, you know, y'all heard about it. And they'd make a contract with the devil, and after that all they had to do was fart and they got a hit record. Well, this one is, we are making a contract with God. And we better take it pretty serious. And it tells us to think well before taking this step. I want you to know, if you were going to form a contract with the devil, you better think well before taking that step. And I want you to know, if you're going to enter into a contract with God, you better think just as well. Because God's going to put all himself into his half of the contract. All of his power. And he expects me to put all of my sincerity into it. When we sincerely took such a position, think well before taking this step. And it says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. That's where I gave up managing my life. And more I became interested in seeing what I could do to contribute, it says. This is the point at which I realized that my needs are getting met by me helping others. This is the point at which I realized I quit being a taker in life and became a giver. Because I learned that when I got on the giving end of you, I got on the receiving end of God. I clearly understood the terms and conditions. Established on such a footing. That means that I'm supposed to be firmly fixed in my understanding that I have entered into a contract with the All-Powerful. And after that, you're not supposed to blink. Established on such a footing. He would provide what I needed with all his power. If I would keep close to him and perform his work well. And that, by the way, paraphrases into our primary purpose, to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. Our primary purpose. The big book says that we have been given a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. And if I want to have an ever-awakening awareness of a growing experience with the power of God in my life, it's going to accompany my effort at that primary purpose. I know today that somehow, me getting what I need from God, whatever it is going to be connected to me keeping close to Him and performing His work well. You know, I've had people say, Dave, that's all you talk about. That's all. Of course, it's all it asked me to do. I say, read it right here. It says, if I would keep close to him and perform his work well, he would bring all his power to bear upon my life and provide what I need and remove my difficulties. And what he asked me to do was, I didn't read nothing else. Of course I say nothing else. When I go talk at a treatment center, if everything I share, any talk I ever do, doesn't end up on this, then I haven't finished. Because it all ties back into my contract with God. There ain't nothing else. Read it for yourself. It's on page 63. To keep close to Him and perform His work well is the answer to all my needs. So, how do I do that? Well, I'll tell you, that's what the rest of the steps are for. Step 4 through 9 is my initial effort to get close to God, to remove the things that block me. And then step 10, 11, and 12 is how I keep close to Him and perform His work well. 10, 11, and 12. So, you know, we want to get to those maintenance steps. That's keeping close to Him and perform His work well. But let's don't just blow by them steps 4 through 9. They're worth being painstaking about. If we are painstaking, it says, about this phase of our development, we will begin to be amazed before we're halfway through. You know, it says, and when we finish all those house cleaning steps and have established our contact with God, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. I want you to know that that is still a ninth step promise. As we cleaned up the past, we have entered the world of the Spirit. And what a world it is. The big book says that the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. The world of the Spirit. Be painstaking about them steps. It's worth it. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Now here's how we keep close to Him and perform His work well. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, now there's four things we watch for. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, there's four things we do about it. We ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately. We make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Our contract. My sponsor, my first sponsor hammered this passage so much it got to be annoying. You know, I didn't appreciate the value of it yet. I just got tired of hearing him say it. You know, every freaking meeting they'd say, he was an old man at our group, and so they would usually say, Ed, you got anything you want to share today before we close? He'd go, are you continuing to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? All the time. Ed, you got anything else you want to say, Ed? Yeah, are you continuing to watch for, all the time. You know, you could walk in some morning, and if your smile wasn't on just right, he'd say, how's your serenity today, boy? And you'd say, well, it's a little off today. And he'd say, well, are you continuing to watch for selfishness? No, I haven't done that yet this morning. Well, did you ask God at once to remove that? Have you discussed it with someone? And turn your thought. No, I haven't done that yet, Ed. He'd say, well, thank God. Because he said, if you hadn't done that and still felt this way, I wouldn't know what to tell you. Ed said this was a ranch that would fit any nut. He meant that this passage right here was the action you take to get the gears turning to bring the solution to any problem. Today I know he meant it. But I didn't learn it easy. Until one day, I got a letter in the mail from Social Security. See, I also get a bit of a disability check. And, I just finished that nine stuff and was getting some relief from the fear of financial insecurity that drove me into, all that stuff. And I was just getting some relief from that. And I got this letter from Social Security that said, your check is going to be cut. This was Thanksgiving, the beginning of Christmas season. Y'all know me and Norma do Christmas big. And I got a letter that said, your check is going to be cut $600 a month starting the 1st of December. Whoa, a two-week notice was all they gave me. And the fear of financial insecurity that was just kind of slipping away jumped back on me with a vengeance and was crushing me into the ground. And in that moment, I heard the voice of God. Sounded like Ed Hasbro. Said, ask God to remove that fear, boy, and discuss it with someone immediately. Make amends quickly if you've harmed anyone. And resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. I thought, what does resolutely mean? You know, I mean, this is Christmas, and New Year's is right around the corner. I knew people would be making these New Year's resolutions. You know, they're going to go on a diet. They're going to quit smoking. I knew they meant, bless God, come the 1st of January, they're going to dig in, plant their feet, push against that, resist the urge to have a cigarette. That's resolve, you know, resolutely. I wondered if resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you could help was the same idea. That meant that, by God, I'm supposed to plant my feet, lean into that fear, and push. Push through it and reach out and help another alcoholic. And so that's what I did. I called my sponsor and reported to him my fear. I didn't know any amends on this situation, if we have harmed anyone, it says. There was no amends to be made about this one. But I started turning my thoughts to someone I could help. I started going to meetings looking for someone to help. I didn't know how to help them very well yet. I was kind of new in this recovery. But if I heard somebody sharing in that meeting that they was having a bad day, I'd get whoever I rode to the meeting with and say, help me find them after the meeting. People still joke about that because I still do it. Old Sam at Western Trails, when he's walking up to somebody and they see him coming, they go, here comes Dave's messenger. I look for those people to pray with them, to share a word with them, to give them a phone number, to get a phone number. I call them usually before they call me. And I wasn't this time because I needed to turn my thoughts to someone I can help. You know, and I would pray with people, and I'd be home at evening reading my big book and go, oh, wow, man, I wish I had knew this passage this morning. This is what I needed to share with them. And I'd write that down or, you know, mark where it was. I couldn't wait to go back to the meeting tomorrow and look for them and read that to them and share it with them. And, you know, in the process of me trying to pick up other people and cheer them on, I got carried through. You know, we went through the greatest Christmas, me and Norma. We always have a great Christmas. This one was no lacking. There was no lacking of presents under the tree. We came to the 1st of January and sat down to pay, you know, figure up our budget. We do the budget twice a month. First half of the month, we sat down and figured it up. And we had enough money in the bank to pay the bills. And we wasn't sure how that happened. And we decided to go ahead and figure the budget for the whole month. And it was a little scary to look that far into the future, you know. But we added it up, and it said we were going to hit the end of January $500 short. And me and Norma, I said, Norma, if you get scared, ask God to remove that fear at once. Discuss it with someone immediately. Make amends quickly if you harm anyone. And turn your thoughts to someone you can help. And I thought, oh no, I'm starting to sound like Ed. But you know what? We came to the 1st of February with all the bills paid. And didn't know how it happened. 1st of March, all the bills were paid. 1st of April. 1st of May. Somewhere around May, we began, you know, between making some life adjustments and getting certain things resolved, you know, it all balanced itself back out. But I can tell you that for 5 months, including the Christmas holidays, life didn't miss a beat. And I still don't understand it. I've sat down at times and tried to think back and wonder how I got through that time. You know, I can remember a few things. Like, for example, toward the end of February, I knew we was getting down at the bottom of the checking account, you know, and I didn't want to bounce any checks, so I figured I better call the bank and double check, make sure that I knew we was down to our last few nickels and dimes there, and I better double check. Didn't want to start bouncing checks. So I called the bank, and that little recording said that I had $500 in my checking account. I couldn't believe that I had made a $500 miscalculation. You say, well, are you saying that God put $500 in your checking account? I wouldn't say that either, but I really don't know what to say, except that I was real happy about it. You know, I mean, I ran and grabbed my gratitude journal. You know, I started learning to do that. And if you haven't started doing it, it's a good practice. I grabbed my gratitude journal. I'm flipping to the February page. I'm going to write in there this entry about $500 more than I thought we had in the checking account. And as I turned by the January page, I noticed an entry there in January that said, I called the bank today. There was $100 in the bank more than I thought we had. I said, oh yeah, I remember that. Just little things. Those are some of the bigger ones. I remember in March, one night, because I stay up at night. I usually sleep during the day, but this particular, I stayed up all night Friday. Saturday, I didn't get a chance to sleep. I was up all day Saturday. And then toward the end of the day, Norma said, what do you want to do tonight? And, I didn't really want to do anything, you know. And but there was supposed to be a good speaker over at Western Trails, they said. And I said, well, if you want to, we go to Western Trails. There's supposed to be a good speaker over there, and you can listen to the speaker, and I can doze in my chair if I need to. So we drive over there. It's 5 minutes to eight. We drive, pull up to the door. I'm walking up, and as I reach for the door handle, the door flew open, and the chairperson came out and grabbed me and said, "Dave, my great speaker just called and canceled." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Will you speak?" No way. I want you to know, I've done a lot of speaking since then, but I had never spoken up to him. I had just started going to detox with a few friends and taking a few minutes, my little turn. And I was trying to learn how to get better at that. And for someone to come up to me when I haven't hardly slept all night or all day and say, "Would you be our speaker?" When the room was packed with all these people who'd come to hear a great speaker, no. I said, "No, I can't do that. And Norma said, "You can do it, Dave." She pulled me off to the side and prayed with me. And they took me in there and propped me up behind the podium and said, "With 5 minutes notice, here it's Blind Dave." And I went, I was born in Houston, Texas, in 1948, and I kind of fumbled around and chugged along a little bit. And a few minutes into it, I felt something happen. I compare it to one time. I remember one time when we was teenagers, one of my buddies had just got his first car. And we drove off down some country road, way down dirt road. We got way down in there. It was muddy, and we slid off the road into the ditch, and we were sunk in the mud. And he had to hitchhike back to town and get a tow truck to come out there. And they had to stretch a long cable down there to get hold of that car. And, so we're sitting in there. You rev up the engine, and you're getting ready to... And so the guy in that tow truck said, "Okay, I'm fixing to take the slack out of this chain. You get ready." And you're sitting there, got your foot on the accelerator, and all of a sudden that slack comes out of that chain, and you feel it go, ka-choo. Y'all had that happen, haven't you? And that car just started sliding, they were pulling us out of there. That's what it felt like that night. I'm sitting there fumbling around, sliding in this mud, stuck, and all of a sudden, ka-choo. And I was in tow. And, I'll never forget that night. Every time I think of it, it puts a lump in my throat. I've had many of them experiences since. And that was my first real experience of this type. And man, I want you to know, it was like a grand slam home run. And at the end of that, then people jumped and cheered for a long time. I was the man of the hour. And it felt good too, I want you to know. And they were all over me at the end of that meeting, Boy, how cool that was. And finally, everybody was gone, and me and Norma's driving home. The excitement's over. Now I'm sleepy again, And we get home, walk in the door, and Norma says, "Hey, somebody came up to me and said that someone gave them a note to give to me to read to you when we got home." I said, "Cool. What does it say?" And she unfolded this note. $500 fell out of it. And we got through March. That was my initiation into what it means to be established on this footing. Think well before taking this step. If you mean business, God means business. You keep close to Him and perform His work well, and nothing else matters. And God said that if I would keep close to Him and perform His work well, He would provide what I need and remove all my difficulties, and He did. The big book says both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. There's your primary purpose. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When you look back, you'll realize that all that came to you when you put your life in God's hands was better than anything you could have planned. Follow the dictates of your higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Follow the dictates of your higher power. What are those dictates? He dictated the terms. You follow them. Keep close to Him and perform His work well. Step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. And so it tells us, instructions on how to do that. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? I said, wait a minute. This sounds like step 10. I said, well, this is just, it says, do we owe an apology? Step 10 said, we make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Said, are we, step 11 says, are we keeping something to ourselves or should it be discussed with another person at once? Step 10 said, we discuss it with someone immediately. Step 11 says, were we thinking of ourselves most of the time or were we thinking of what we could do for others? Step 10 said, resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Were we kind and loving toward all? Step 10 said, love and tolerance of others. I said, this is just a repeat of step 10. Why are they calling it step 11? Well, the next sentence told me so. I said, after making our review, we inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Step 11 begins to bring in this ability to ask God for guidance. Step 10 said, whenever these crop up. Step 11 begins to suggest not waiting till the crap hits the fan, but to begin to establish some disciplines of an evening and morning little time with God. An evening review, a morning prayer and meditation and reflection. And to establish that as a habit. And where I'm supposed to begin to ask God to talk to me is when I say, God, have I been selfish today? And see if He points anything out that I need to correct. Have I been dishonest today? That's where I begin to get familiar with the voice of God. And after I've been practicing that a while, I can begin to ask God what corrective measures should be taken and for guidance in other affairs of my life, in all my affairs. It's a wonderful way to live. And, you know, and I will develop this ability over time. You know, the big book, Step 11 says, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. You will. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. And that's what step 10 is. It's the constant practice of these things. And my step 10 begins to just sort of develop into a step 11 where I find myself asking God what corrective measures, asking God for guidance in specific matters. So you learn to get familiar with the voice of God in this program, you know, this voice of intuition. And it, so it says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? You know, I go through that little list every night. Today I know the most important thing for me to do in my life is that. That's keeping close to Him. Performing His work well and everything else is God communicating to me through me doing that and maintaining a conscious contact with God. And I want you to know that most nights I go to bed and am able to go right down that list, check, 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 and say, thank you, God, for a good day. Okay, cool, thank you. And so I get a good score most of the time, but I'm going to tell you about a time when I did not. You know, a few years ago we had a hellacious hailstorm in South Austin, destroyed so many rooms, and mine was one. And so I called out the guy to come out and give me an estimate. He crawled up there on the roof, and he come down. He said, well, I'll see about $3,200 worth of damage up there, and you got a $900 deductible, so we will pay for $2,300. I said, cool. And he said, you've got a year to settle this claim. I said, I'm going to need a year to save up my $900 deductible. So I thought no more. That was in October. I thought no more about it till we swung all the way around to June. And I thought, whoa, man, the year's about up. I better start thinking about this $900 deductible. So I called the roofer to come out. He went up there and looked and come down. And I said, then what's the bid? He says, $5,000. I was, oh, God, that dude told me, that insurance guy told me $3,200. He said, well, he must not have looked very closely. He said, you got two roofs up there. And he said, now I'm going to have to take both of them off to put a new one on. He said, because those weren't put on right, and water's leaked all under here, and he said, all your decking is rotten. And he said, all the tubifers that jet out past the wall are rotten all the way around the house. The fascia is rotten all the way around the house. He said, and I got to fix all that before I can put a new roof on. He said, and that's not hail damage. Your insurance isn't going to cover it. Oh, God. Oh, now I'm freaking out a little bit. And then Norma comes in and says, hey, guess what? I can retire 5 years earlier if we buy back that 5 years of my retirement. I said, well, how much is that? She said, $4,250. I said, I can't worry about that right now. I'm trying to worry about this roof. You know, she said, well, the price is going to go up in October. I said, well, I've got till October to do the roof. Oh, God. So now I go to bed at night and I'm saying, okay, was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Yeah, I see a little bit of fear here. I said, God, please remove this fear at once. I'm going to get up tomorrow, call my sponsor, report in, tell him I'm afraid. You know, y'all know the routine. I'm learning it. And, you know, so I jump in bed and I'm going to bed. And just before I go to sleep, I heard that little voice that said, did you ever finish paying for your seeing eye dog? I thought, I thought, that wasn't God. That wasn't God. So I tried. You know, back in 82, I went and got a CNI dog. I'm going to go over a few minutes. Back in 82, I went and got a CNI dog, you know. They told us, they used to give those dogs away, but they found out we'd take better care of them if they charged us some. So they started making us pay a little bit, and they said, we don't care how you pay it. You can pay it however you want, $1 a month, we don't care, just as long as you pay it and don't get some charity to pay it for you. I said, cool. So I went back home, there's no pressure there. I went back to Houston, you know, and I went through a divorce. And I left that marriage with a lot of debt. And since CNI wasn't really pressuring me, I pushed that one to the back of the pile, and I think I might have forgot it. Here I am 20-something years later, 5 years sober, in the midst of a dilemma, and I'm saying, God, what do I do? And God says, did you ever finish paying for your sin? I thought, who wants to hear that? You know? So, you know, I said, that wasn't God. I went to sleep. And I woke up the next day, I'm walking around the house saying, that wasn't God, that wasn't God, that wasn't God, that wasn't God. And I finally got myself convinced it wasn't God. And I was starting to feel okay, and you know. And I go into the kitchen to start dinner that evening, and I've got a radio on the table. I listen to all kind of talk radio stuff, you know. And I clicked on the radio, and I went in the kitchen, and the first words that came out of the radio, this lady said, hi, I'm Jane Doe. She said, today we're going to be talking to John Smith. Said, John Smith recently went blind, and he went and got a CNI dog. He was talking about a CNI dog. So I clicked off the radio. And I stood there for a minute, scared. And I looked up and I said, God, I can't afford to pay that right now. And what came booming back at me said, you can't afford not to. What are the rules of the game? Keep close to him and perform his work well. Keep close to him as that amends stuff. Do you want God in the game? Or do you want to handle this one by yourself? I said, yes, sir, I can't afford not to. And I called CNI. I said, I may owe y'all some money from about 1982. And he said, my God, I don't know if we got records back that far. He said, I have to call you back in a few days. I got to check the microfilm or something, you know. So he called me back and he said, yes, sir, Mr. Archibald, you still owe us $35. Oh, oh, God, I was so glad. Oh, God, I thought it was going to be a big deal, you know. And I wrote out a $35 check and dropped it in the mail. And I said, God, you sure made a big fuss over $35. And I felt that little comforting thing. I said, well, you know, you didn't know it was $35. You thought it was a lot more, and you were willing to do it. You know, it says that he will match our calamity with serenity when we do what we're supposed to do, doesn't it? And there I was. I felt God's arms wrap around me, and I just felt like it was all going to be okay. You know, and shortly after that, I'm sitting on my living room floor doing step work with the guy. And I mentioned about my roof and found out he was an old roofer. He said, let me look at that. He went up and looked and came down and said, what did they say they'd pay? And I said, well, deducting my $900 deductible, they're going to pay $23. He said, I'm going to put that roof on there for $2,300. And he went and got a roofing buddy of his that was new in recovery. And they put my whole roof on and got all the repairs and everything for that $2,300. Cost me nothing out of pocket. And then I called up the teacher retirement guy. I said, you come over here and help me figure out what I'm going to do about Norma's retirement. He comes over and he's looking and he says, well, let's see. He said, Norma, what's this deduction off your check over here? And she said, I don't know. Forgot. He said, I used to work for that company that they're putting a little bit of money in for your retirement. He said, you know, that's not a very good company. That's why I changed to this other one. He said, let me close out that account, roll that money over into this account, and we'll do this, and we'll, I don't know today what all he did. I didn't understand what he was saying, but when he got through doing his little sleight of hand and shuffling the cards and dealt out me a new hand, I had Norma's retirement in the bag, and that didn't cost me nothing either. I got a new roof, and I got Norma's 5 years of retirement, and it cost me nothing. Take it back. Cost me $35. To keep close to him and perform his work well. Now resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. You know, God don't want me stressing out about things like that. The big book says we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. That would diminish my usefulness to others. There's where God wants me. God says, give me that stuff. You go do this. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. It happens that because of your own drugging and drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. I want you to know that God can do something very unique for alcoholics through alcoholics. That's what I learned at step two. That's what was different about AA for me instead of church. God can do something very unique for alcoholics through alcoholics. And it happens that because of your own drugging and drinking experience that you can be a unique tool in the hand of God to save the life of other alcoholics and addicts. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. Your job now is to be at the place where you can be at maximum service to God and the people about you in this fellowship. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. There's your inventory. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it your relationship with Him is right. There's your inventory. And great events shall come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. You can't afford not to. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. You can't afford not to. Clear away the wreckage of your past. You can't afford not to. Give freely of what you find. You can't afford not to. And join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.